Just like Ajahn Sanna, we always tell a lot of stories as monks. And some of those stories are very powerful. So powerful that some of those have literally saved people's lives. And in particular, there was one lady who was going through a divorce. It was so terrible for her that many times she considered suicide. And those stories kept her together. And when she got through the trauma of that separation, she came up to me and begged me to please write some of those stories in the book. And of course I said no. Too much hard work. So she started to write out the stories herself. She sent a few to me, and they were so awful. There's no other way. So I wrote them out. And number two, I decided to publish them commercially, because I've seen that many of the books are free distribution, they only get so far, and they don't get out to the general public. So the only way to get really good teachings out there is to put them into a book and to publish them commercially. So I apologise for the cost of it, but the reason for that is that so ordinary people, wherever they are, they can go in the bookshop and they can have access to some of these really wonderful teachings. So that's what I did it for. And there's lots of stories in there, and I'm sure you can get hold of those stories later on. They're just stories about life. We all know that the Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths, but these days, you've probably all heard me say this on my talks, and I'm sure Ajahn Sanna says the same thing. If we just start to focus on suffering, because that's what most people do when they start saying the Four Noble Truths, suffering, the cause of suffering, the end of suffering, and the way leading out of suffering, all people hear is suffering. You have enough of that in your home life. You don't want to come to a monastery and hear more about it. And so it's just the emphasis which sometimes is put on Buddhism, especially on this type of Buddhism. So we change it around. And I usually start with the third noble truth first, because the Buddha taught the end of suffering is Nibbana, otherwise known as the ultimate, the highest happiness. So I tell the Four Noble Truths is happiness, the cause of happiness. That sometimes we're unhappy, but why we're unhappy? It's just simple marketing, because when you do that, not only do you interest people, but also you get to the heart of what this Buddhism is all about, and creating more and more happiness to the ultimate happiness. And so this story is not about the ultimate happiness, it's just about creating more happiness in one's daily life. So this Buddha's teachings can go wider into the community, showing that through wise strategies, through clever understanding, through a good attitude about life, you can stop a lot of suffering. I wanted to talk more about meditation today, according to Ajahn Sanna, we discussed this earlier. But there's one story in that book which covers just ordinary life, and also the path of meditation. And that's a story which occurred when one of my monks was going to visit a prison. He used to go and visit prisons very, very often. In fact, the first time I went to visit a prison, I was very impressed, because of a prison population of maybe 105, 106, over 90 turned up. So a huge number of prisoners came to learn about meditation. And I was so impressed that these so-called prisoners really wanted to do something to improve their lives, that I really wanted to try and give a very, very good talk. So I was really getting into it. But only after about 5 minutes, this big prisoner with lots of scars on stood up, interrupted me, and said, "May I ask a question?" When someone that size interrupts you, you always say, "Yes, please, what do you want?" He actually later became a great friend. He was a very nice person. He said, "Is it really true, Venerable Sir, that through meditation you can learn how to fly through the air?" And then I realised why so many prisoners have come to an invitation. You can't make these stories up, it happened. And when I said that it takes many, 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 many years, and only special people can actually do levitation, then the next time I taught in jail, only three prisoners took. But we had great fun teaching in prisons, and on this one occasion, which is more important, there was one of my monks, it wasn't myself, one of my monks had been teaching in this high security jail for a long time, and the prisoners wanted to invite him to stay back a little bit longer for a cup of tea so that they could get to know their teacher. So after the session, serving this monk tea, they started to ask him obvious questions like, what's it like in a Buddhist monastery? And so he started to tell them about the routine in our monastery. He said, in my monastery, he said, we get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. But it's optional. You can always get up earlier if you want to. And the prisoners were aghast. 4 o'clock in the morning. Even in prison, you don't have to get up that early. But then what can you do? Can you turn on a CD player and listen to some music? No, we don't have any of that in the monastery. You just have to meditate all morning. And then what do you do? Can you have a breakfast? In my monastery, very often we don't have breakfast. What? Even in prison they give you a breakfast every morning. And then usually we work very hard in our monastery in Perth, Western Australia. We work in the morning time. Building, pushing wheelbarrows, really hard physical labour. And again, that astounded the prisoners, because even in jail they don't work that hard. At least you can have lunch. Yeah, we have lunch, and it's all in the same bowl. Sometimes. Especially when the things are served. Now here we actually help ourselves, but sometimes the food is served. And sometimes the custard goes on the curry. Sometimes the ice cream melts on top of the spaghetti. And the prisoner says, don't you have compartments in your bowls? No. That's disgusting, they said. What do you do in the afternoon? Can you watch the TV? You don't have any TV. Do you have any sport? Can you play soccer? Any sex? Of course not, we're monks. What do you do in the afternoon then? Meditate. Oh my goodness. But I suppose you have a nice dinner in the evening. No dinner. We have to meditate all day. Can't you even play cards or go with poker or something in the evening? No, just meditating. And then at night, you sleep on the floor. What? They don't even give you a bed. Even in solitary, they give you at least a platform to sleep on. And these prisoners, they were so disgusted at the harshness and austerity of my monastery. And that their monk, who they got to like, had to endure such asceticism that one of them forgot where they were and said, that's terrible in your monastery. Why don't you come in here and stay with us? He was invited to stay in prison. And the poor man never realised what he was saying until everyone started laughing. And of course the story got back to me. And he started thinking, reflecting, why is my monastery far more austere than any prison? But people are queuing up to get into my monastery. We have 21 monks there at the moment. And other people like to join, there's no space. But why is it that people are queuing up to leave prison? What's the difference between a monastery and a prison? Or rather, what's the difference between freedom and being in a prison? And the answer is that a prison is any place or situation where you don't want to be. So, if you are in a relationship where you don't want to be, your relationship becomes a prison for you. If you're in a job you hate, your job feels like a prison. If you're in a body which is old or sick or ugly, you don't like it, your body becomes a prison. And if you're in a sala listening to a talk you don't want to be here, this is a prison for you. And how do you escape from prison? You do not need to get out of the door. You don't need to change your partner, your job, or even your body. The way to escape from the prisons which you make in life is to change your attitude. Instead of not wanting to be here, you become content to be here. If you're content with your partner, then you feel freedom. If you're content with your job, content with your body, even if it's in pain, then you feel freedom. Even if you're content to listen to this talk, then you feel free. Freedom is any place or situation where you're content to be. Being in a prison is any place you don't want to be. That's in life, but it's also in your meditation. If you're meditating, you don't want to be here. You want to be somewhere else. You want to be in jhana. You want to be enlightened. Come on, quick. Then you don't feel free at all. Your mind becomes a prison for you. But as soon as you're content to be here, if your mind is wandering all over the place, if you have sloth and torpor, if you're not peaceful at all, but you're content to be like that, then that's the beginning of freedom. That's the difference between being in a prison and being free. And too many people, even when they meditate, put themselves in prison. They don't want to be here, they want to be in jhana. You never get to jhanas that way, because all these deep meditation states are all born of freedom. So now do you understand what freedom is? And what being in a prison is? So stories like that are in this book over here, which is applicable mostly to daily life, but can also be applied to the deeper practices of meditation as well. That's what it's all about. Okay, over to you. I don't show that. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to just request that we were just touching on some meditation techniques. Now, one of the most universal methods of meditation in the Buddhist world is meditation on breath. And though it's universal and enormous amounts have been written about it, talked about it, it still can be confusing, difficult, maybe because too much has been thought about it. So it's important to get some instructions that lead to profitable results. Ajahn Brahmavamsa has spent the last 31 years or so having to reflect on breath meditation and other types of meditation, but I'd like to get him to talk about specifically the kind of instructions that he gives to people, because he teaches breath meditation and has for many, many years, and has had to contemplate what is effective in his own practice and what is helpful and effective for lay people as well with this particular invaluable and central practice, which is not only a Buddhist practice, but certainly profitable for anybody who takes it up. And I thought, since Ajahn Brahm, we do have, of course, several talks and books by Ajahn Brahm on this topic, but since he's here in the flesh, I thought I would like to get him to give the very up-to-date instructions that he gives in his retreats, etc., for the people in this very room, so that they're not in doubt about it anymore, and we have right from the abbot's mouth.
Well, you could have said the horse's mouth.
I was, but
yeah. Okay, first of all, when you're meditating, the first thing you always have to be careful of is posture. Posture is crucial on breath meditation. It doesn't matter how your legs are. They can be one this way, one the other way, I don't care. It doesn't matter if your back is straight or if you're slumped over. The most important part of your posture is around your mouth. Make sure it's smiling. Well, I say that's not a joke. Sometimes when you teach meditation, Remember, when you are facing the teacher, for the teacher is facing all of you, and sometimes it's the most frightening experience. And see all these miserable people. And it doesn't take that much. You're sitting down there, the first thing you do, once you've got your body pretty settled, smile. Because whenever you smile, whenever you make a smile, physically, just psychologically, that has a way of pointing the mind in a way of happiness and joy. You're just starting the meditation off, relaxed, easy, looking for fun. And the best meditation has to be joyful, otherwise you don't get anywhere except stressed out. Really the main rest of the posture isn't important. You can sit on a chair, sit on 10 cushions if you want to, I don't care. As long as the body is at ease and you start with an inclination towards inner happiness. So that's the first one. And then you have to just allow, this is basically because of core teaching of the Buddha. When I read it in Pali, it was stood out so prominently, it was a key to success in meditation. And that little saying is Sukhino Chittam Samadhi Yati. The mind gets still in meditation because of happiness. Sukhino means from happiness. The mind, samadhis basically, gets peaceful. So we have to look for that happiness in meditation, generate it, cultivate it. So once we get a comfortable body, put a little smile on the face, the next thing we should always do is remind ourselves that the meditation is a time for making the mind peaceful and calm, not for thinking or working out problems. It's not a time for contemplating. You can leave that until later. When you tell yourself quite clearly what the direction of this journey is going to be, there's a good chance the mind will follow that journey, will follow that direction. So just psych yourself up, tell yourself what you expect yourself to do in the next half hour, hour, 2 hours, whatever. And then the next thing you should do is to wait for a few minutes. Because just as if you go out of a lit room into the forest at night time, it takes a couple of minutes for your eyes to accommodate to the little light which is in the darkness, so you can see things. In the same way, when you close your eyes, after a couple of minutes, only then can you start to feel your body. So I usually wait for a while, maybe 1 or 2 minutes, when the sensitivity can pick up all of the feelings in the body, then you make your final adjustments to your posture. But ever imagine you can get into a perfect posture from the beginning. Do the best you can, wait a couple of minutes, and then look again and make the final adjustments. And the next thing, you have to have some preparation before you even start watching the breath. So I have encouraged my students for a long time now to spend the first period of time just allowing yourself to come into the present moment, just now. What you can do is learning the simile of the gatekeeper. Simile of the gatekeeper goes like this. You come to a nice monastery, but being a very wealthy person and living in a neighborhood where there's many thieves, you tell your gatekeeper, please be careful, do not allow any thieves to come into my house. There are burglars around. Be mindful. Be alert, you tell your gatekeeper. Then you go to the temple and hear this wonderful talk from Ajahn Sona. And when you go back home, you find your house has been burgled. And you tell your gatekeeper, I thought I told you to be mindful. And your gatekeeper said, but sir, I was mindful. I noted the burglars going in. Burglar, burglar, burglar. I noticed your state-of-the-art LCD TV set, crystal set, go out, going out, going out, going out. I noticed them going in again, burglar going in again, jewelry going out, jewelry going out, jewelry going out. I noted everything. I was very mindful. That's very cheeky, but I don't mind saying that. Because the mindfulness is not enough. You've got to tell the gatekeeper who is allowed in and who is not allowed in. If you tell the gatekeeper, it's just an aspect of your mind. It is just a part of mindfulness to be a gatekeeper. It's the Buddha's own simile. So you tell your gatekeeper in the first stage of meditation who is allowed in and who is not allowed in. You say in the first stage, you can allow anything which is to do with the present moment, with now. But keep out the thieves of past and future. Any thought, memory of the past, any planned expectation of the future, keep out. If you tell the gatekeeper that, we'll usually do it. You only need to tell it a couple of times, and it will get on with the job. One of the problems in all types of meditation is we don't know how to give instructions and shut up. Suppose, you know, your car was broken down, maybe you ordered a taxi to come and take you from here into Kamloops Airport. You imagine you got in that taxi and you told the driver, I want to go to Kamloops Airport. Don't go this way, don't go that way, go this way over here. Also, because I'm a Buddhist, I want you to go just the middle path, not too fast, not too slow. Please allow anybody else to come in. Be careful of any animals on the path because you don't want to sort of crush them. I'm a Buddhist, do it this way. And stop talking because I want to be quiet, I want to be... If you carry on like that to a taxi driver, he'll throw you out before you get to the end of the drive. All you need to do for a taxi driver is just to say, I want to go to the airport and then shout. And he will drive the vehicle his way. You know where the airport is. So you don't need to give all those instructions. In that simile, what I mean is very often people say, okay, be in the present moment. Come on, be in the present moment. Don't be in the present moment this way. Be in the present moment that way. Come on, do it this way, do it that way. You always give instructions so fast, so much, that the poor mindfulness doesn't have a chance to do its job. But just say something once, twice, or most three times, and then be quiet. And be patient enough for the mind to do the job. It will take time, but the mind will know what to do if you give it clear instructions and you don't keep confusing it. And after a while you get into the present moment, you're just here in the present moment, just now. It's a very pleasant place to be. You're free from all of the burdens of your past. You're free from all the expectations of the future. You're just here. This is good enough. And you next develop an even more precise present moment awareness. When you're right in the in the center of the present moment, then you find you're silent. You're not describing things anymore, because all of those descriptions are things which have just happened of the past. In this present moment, things are right here. You haven't got time to say anything before the next moment arrives. In that little green book, I told the simile of like being a host at a party. With so many guests coming in, you can't afford to greet or to have a conversation with the guests coming in now. All you can do is greet them and then go on to the next guest who comes right behind. This is like present moment awareness. All these moments of experiencing coming in one after the other, you can't linger with a conversation on any moment or you'll miss the next one. You can't even say their name. Just moments flow silently. So you get to a silent present moment awareness. And then, only then, when you're reasonably in the present, reasonably silent, only then should you go on to the breath. One of the big mistakes which I did when I was a young monk was to try and get onto the breath too soon when I wasn't calm and quiet enough to actually to do it. My mind wasn't ready for the breath. And if you try to watch the breath too soon, you've got to use so much force, control, to even keep the breath in mind for a few minutes, that you get what I first heard in Malaysia, samadhi headache. Samadhi headache is when you're trying so hard, you get so tense, actually you're more tense after meditation than when you began. You know the breath meditation is called Anapanasati? I call that Anapanasati, meditation on breath. Which is not the way to go. So, preparation, like anything else, is vital. Prepare yourself. And then when you start to watch the breath, you just tell the gatekeeper, please be aware of the breath. Be aware of the breath, be aware of the breath, that's all. This question came up this morning, but there's other people here today, this afternoon. Too many people do not do breath meditation. They do nose meditation or sometimes belly meditation. The Buddha never said to watch your belly. He never said to watch the tip of the nose. The Buddha said to watch the breath. So for people who are meditating for the first time, I give them the basic instruction, sit down, close your eyes, breathe in and out 3 times, after the 3rd breath open your eyes, which everybody manages to do. Then I ask them, how did you know that you were breathing in and out 3 times? It doesn't matter where you knew, however you know you're breathing in and out 3 times. That is the same thing you watch in the breath meditation. Now sit down, close your eyes, and watch 3,000 breaths, I say. But the point is that where you watch the breath, how you watch the breath, what you're actually watching, that's actually how you find out what you're supposed to watch. That feeling which tells you what the breath is doing. You don't try and locate that feeling anywhere, because sometimes you might watch the tip of the nose and it's not there. You can't find it. You ask your teacher, I can't find the breath. Of course, because you're looking in the wrong place. You have to watch the breath where it manifests, not where it should be, but where it actually is. You can always know what the breath is doing. Just ask yourself, am I breathing in or am I breathing out? Of course you know. And that's all you need to do for breath meditation. You just know the breath is going in, you know the breath is going out. That's all. So that's how you start. You also develop contentment, like I said in that earlier story. It doesn't matter how the breath is, rough or smooth, whatever's happening, just be content. In fact, at this point, it's important to know, for great success in breath meditation, you should also pay a lot of attention, probably even more attention on the breath itself, to the space between you and your meditation object, the breath. So you see, not just breathing in, breathing out, but you also recognize how you're watching the breath. Because a lot of meditators, you're so highly motivated, you watch the breath with control. You're so afraid of losing awareness. You grasp onto that breath so tightly. There's no way the breath meditation could proceed much further. Make sure you put contentment, peace, letting go, kindness, freedom, and all these words which describe the same thing between you and your breath. Put peace between you and the breath. So you're not trying to control the breath. This morning we're talking a little bit about loving kindness meditation. It's great, put loving kindness between you and your breath. This little breath, just like this wonderful being who's served you so much, who's looked after you and cared for you, bringing you oxygen throughout your whole life and taking away all the waste products. What a wonderful servant this breath has been. And I've taken it for granted my whole life. So I'm now going to care for my little breath. I look upon it like some little teddy bear and I cuddle my breath. Oh, you lovely little breath. Oh, you're so nice and so warm and peace. If you put that sort of loving kindness towards the breath, then of course you're putting the right object between you and your breath. Something which is gentle, which is peaceful. For those of you who know more about meditation, you know the main task of breath meditation, or most meditations, according to the Buddha, is to abandon the 5 hindrances. The 5 hindrances do not lie in the breath, they don't lie in you, they lie between you and the breath. Desire and ill will especially. So when you're watching the breath, you're making sure there's no desire between you and your breath. You're just at peace with it. You don't want anything, you're not trying to get anything, you're not trying to make something happen. put peace between you and your breath. There's no ill will either. You're not doing this because you have to. I'm a monk, I'm supposed to watch the breath, but I don't really like to. I really want to be in bed, sleeping. Whatever it is, make sure that there's no ill will towards you, between you and your object. And then, because there's no ill will or desire between you and the object, those are the main two hindrances. The nature of this process is for the breath to start calming down naturally. When you first watch the breath, all you can see is in and out. As the mind settles down, you start to see more detail of the breath. You can start to see the beginning of the breath, the whole flow from the beginning to the end. You can see the spaces between the breaths. You can see more. And as you see more, that's another stage of meditation, the full awareness of the breath. Then, as you see more, and there's more and more peace built up between you and the breath, the whole thing calms down. You get a very soft breath. And the next stage is usually you lose the perception of the beginning and the end. All you can see is breath happening in this moment. Just like in a great simile in the Visuddhi Magga of a carpenter sawing a piece of wood. When you first start sawing a piece of wood, you can see the end of the saw, you can see the handle, the whole lot. But as you focus in, after a while, all you can see is one sawtooth and one tiny area of the wood where the sawtooth is cutting the wood. You don't know whether that sawtooth is at the beginning or the end of the blade. The perception of beginnings and ends, the perceptions of in and out, have all disappeared. And all you know is breath. Just almost unchanging experience of breath in the moment. A natural development. You don't say, I will now go on to the next state. You don't force the meditation, it happens naturally. In fact, you never go on to a next stage in meditation, you only go into the next stage. The next stage is right in the center of the stage you are in right now. It's a very good simile, so you don't have to throw away anything. Stay where you are, go deeper into it. And that's where you find the next stage in meditation. As you're watching this very simple breath, because it is so peaceful, the breath naturally starts to appear very beautiful, very wonderful, full of joy. It's at this stage of the meditation where things really start to gel. This is where the happiness starts to arise. You're just watching this breath, it's so easy, so much fun. You can sit for long periods without any effort. You just want to sit, that's all, because it's enjoyable. And once the joy starts to arise, then you're off. That's like a springboard in meditation. The most important stage is developing joy with a simple object. And then the joy increases and increases. Until there's more joy than this object, the breath disappears, and in its place comes this incredibly powerful nimitta. This brilliant, beautiful mind. And it's at that stage you get into the deep meditations. You're having a lot of fun, blissed out, ecstatic, very still. And if you don't get excited, that nimitta will develop into a jhana. And there you're off into the beautiful states of mind, which are pregnant with so many insights you wouldn't believe. So that's how we do breath meditation. And it's just so simple. You just sit there, shut up and watch your breath. Nothing to it. The other simile which I gave this morning, many of you missed, is a powerful simile, so I will repeat it. Two ways of making the mind still, or say like watching the breath. I said to mine last time, today I'm going to do the breath. I'm trying to watch the breath. This is the breath, my glass of water. And most people, when they watch the breath, they watch it like this. They're going to hold it still. And they concentrate. Use all the skill and willpower to try and hold this glass of water absolutely still. Every time I try this, I fail. The water still moves. The glass is still shaking. Oh, it's so frustrating if you meditate like this. But one day, you get the message. You find it's a very easy way to meditate. A very easy way to make this glass of water absolutely still. Just put it down for 2 seconds. You don't even have to watch it. Look at it. It just gets still all by itself. You put it down. Actually, when I first put it down, it actually moves more than usual. Expect letting go at first to be more disturbing. But be patient. Just leave it alone. And it settles down all by itself. And it's so easy. There's no effort required at all. And that glass of water next to me is absolutely still. That's how you watch the breath. How you watch the mind. Leave it alone. Don't interfere. Put peace between you and the object. And you find your breath. It's so easy. So simple. To watch it. And it settles down all by itself. Because you're not grasping it. You're not craving. You're not involved with it. You stop the five hindrances. Everything settles down. That was Ajahn Chah's simile. He described the mind like a leaf. It only moves up and down because of the wind. You just stop the wind, and the leaf moves up and down less and less and less, until it comes to a stop, because its natural state is to be still. You make it move. You get out of the way, your mind stops. It becomes still. So that's actually a better meditation. Really easy. Isn't it? So any questions from the floor about that? Because it might be useful if anyone has any comments about it. Alright, here, go on.
How do you just put the mind down? I mean, it's a beautiful simile, but I don't know how to do that.
Very good idea, actually. Again, watch that space between you and your breath. Okay, there's no real space, it's just a metaphor, it's just a way of looking. You create the matrices or matrices by which you meditate. It's just one way of looking, one framework. But it's a very useful framework because it does open up the mindfulness, seeing where the hindrances and the defilements, the attachments play and ruin your meditation. You're just watching your breath and wonder, why is it not settling down? It's because you're watching the breath in the wrong way. So the idea of meditation is not just to keep the breath in mind at all costs. The idea of meditation is to just learn how to let things alone, let things be. So putting peace between you and the breath. Or having loving kindness at this moment. Whatever happens now is good enough. This is good enough for me. Unconditional mindfulness, I call it. You've heard unconditional loving kindness. I just mess around with words. Unconditional mindfulness. So whatever you're aware of now is good enough. Even if you have sloth and torpor, which is one of the biggest hindrances, apparent hindrances, for most meditators. If you have sloth and torpor, you get really dull and sleepy, please don't fight and struggle. Please leave it alone. Please have loving kindness to sloth and torpor. The door of my heart is open to you, sloth and torpor. That's not just a joke. Because the reason why sloth and torpor is there in the beginning is because you've been working and striving far too hard. You've been struggling. And your mind is tired. Sloth and torpor is old karma. The result of past struggles. It means you're tired. And if you struggle even more, you're making more bad karma for your meditation in the future. Too much controlling, too much will, too much ego, wanting. The best way is to leave it alone. Make peace with sloth and torpor. And you'll find because you're making peace with sloth and torpor, whatever energy you have, which is very small this time, is not wasting in struggle. So your energy builds and builds and builds. The sloth and torpor just fades away. Fades away to the power of peace. To understand the physics of this, for a long time I've been talking about the two parts of the mind. This is another framework. Two parts of the mind is the passive part of the mind, which just knows, the mindfulness, the consciousness, just knowing, but without reacting. The second part of the mind is the reactor, You know, the thing which controls, which thinks, which manages, which does this, which does that. Because most people's energy goes into the doing, the controlling, the arguing, the thinking, the managing, trying to make it happen, stopping that thing happening. That consumes just so much energy, that's why you're tired. There's no energy left to go just to basic knowing. That's why you're done. So, understanding that, if you start to struggle and control your mind, you're just wasting more knowing energy. If you leave things alone, you don't struggle, you don't manage, you don't think, you don't control, you don't do anything, then all the energy starts going to the knower, to bare mindfulness, just to consciousness, awareness, whatever you call it, just to knowing. And as the energy builds up, the knowing gets brighter and brighter, and the sovereign problem disappears. It's replaced by peacefulness. When I was a young monk, I would struggle with sloth and torpor. In those days, in Thailand, we were malnourished. The food was disgusting. There was hardly any protein vitamins in there at all. So all we were eating, we were getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning, hardly sleeping, in a very hot climate which our bodies just weren't used to. No wonder we were tired in the morning. It's nature. When I think about it now, what do you expect? Nothing wrong with me, it's just the nature, it's cause and effect, that's all. But I used to struggle so hard with sloth and torpor at 3 o'clock in the morning sitting. And sometimes you break through. But when you broke through into restlessness. So you calm the restlessness down and then you go back into sloth and torpor. You have a pendulum going from restlessness to sloth and torpor, to restlessness to sloth and torpor. You can never find that little way. And it's only years later you figured out, oh, that's what I was doing wrong. You're just giving all your energy to a doer. No wonder when it broke through, you'd just be doing even more. Restlessness. So just make peace with sloth and torpor. Leave it alone. Be kind to it. And then you'll find it disappears very quickly. And it's replaced by beautiful peace. So, this is what I mean by how to meditate.
Can you describe your retreat structure, or lack thereof? Just as a very interesting idea, which I mean, use here as well.
Okay, the joke I have to say first of all, in my retreats we keep noble silence. Which means no bell silence. We don't have any bells. We don't have a stupid bell being rung every hour in the morning. Simply because you can see that my meditation, the way I teach it, is no controlling. And you want to try and emphasize that just in the structure of the retreat, no controlling. You don't even control you by making sure you have to get up at 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock at any time in the morning. No bell silence. One of the first times I did this, there was a lady from Sydney, and the retreat I gave her just outside of that city. She was an executive who came from a very high profile job. She rushed from work to the retreat centre. I don't think she had anything to eat. She came in there incredibly tense for the first talk. She heard what I was saying, and I said, on this retreat you can sleep as much as you like. There are no bells. Whenever you feel like it, you can get up and meditate. You can meditate however long you want, however short you want. This is your retreat. I'll give you a talk every morning, interviews whenever you want them. I'm at your service, but I'm not going to tell you what to do and how to do it. I'm going to suggest. But certainly there's going to be no bells. First morning, most people are up about 5 o'clock. Because they were used to these retreats where you had to get up at that time. She was in bed. She got up for breakfast, had her breakfast, and went back to bed again. She told me for those first few days, because in that retreat centre you had to share rooms. She said the other three girls in her room were looking at her just with so much anger. I said, it's not anger, it's jealousy. They just wish they had the courage to do the same. Because I encouraged her for that, because she had been working so hard in a very high stress job. Rest. She did that for 3 days. After the fourth day, she started getting up early. Naturally, because she felt she wanted to. And by the end of the retreat, she'd overtaken everyone else. She was one of the star meditators at that retreat. At other retreats, which I do sometimes, in interview periods, people come along and they say, I just can't watch the breath. They're getting nowhere, so frustrating. Please give me a method. And my method, when people get stressed out, which is 100% success rate, you wouldn't believe it. It's so easy. I say, right, madam, sir, I order you now to follow this method. Go back into your room, sit down, or lay down and have a sleep. And get up afterwards. Don't put an alarm clock. Don't say how long you're going to sleep for. So go down, have a rest. Whenever you wake up, have a shower, a cup of tea, then come and sit. They always say, that's the best meditation I've had. You know why? Because they relax. They were trying too hard. They were striving. They were struggling. They were trying to get meditation. And so just allowing it to happen. When they really rested, they relaxed. Had a nice shower, a cup of tea, herbal or whatever. And then meditated. I never expected anything. I was relaxed. Felt good. That's when I had a good meditation. So people do stress in their meditation. You try too hard. That's why you don't get success in meditation. If you really want to know, if ever you look in the Dhamma Jhakapavattana Sutta, the first teaching of the Buddha, the third noble truth, the way to enlightenment, the way to abandoning craving, there's four ways of letting go, which the Buddha taught in that sutta. The four ways, the first is chaga, patinissaka, mudi and aliya. Chaga is like liberality, giving. What real giving is, giving, expecting nothing back in return. That's a form of letting go. So you give your bottom, your butt, to the meditation stool or cushion. And please don't expect anything. That's real giving. You give your half an hour or an hour to meditation, but please don't expect to get anything. Any expectation is not letting go. So number one, no expectation. Patinissaka is like throwing things away. Like being in a hot air balloon. To go higher, you have to find something in the basket to throw away. See, not what you can get, but what you can abandon. That's one of Ajahn Chah's famous sayings. You meditate not to get something. You meditate to get rid of things, to throw things away. What you usually do, you throw all the ballast away from the basket. You get so high you can't go any further. You throw your lunch away. Everything else away. You get so high you can't get any further. So what should you do next? Then you have the insight. Throw the basket away. You untie the basket. And there you are, going really high, just hanging on to the ropes of the balloon. And then you go so high but you're still not in nirvana yet. How could you go higher? And then you have the greatest insight. Throw yourself out. When you throw yourself off, then the balloon goes all the way to the bottom. In that simile, the basket is your body and the senses. Your body is a basket case, I say. Forget about it, aches and pains. Throw it away. Let it be. And then the last thing you throw away before you go to nirvana is you, yourself. Only then does a balloon go all the way to nirvana. That's throwing things away. So in your meditation, don't think what you're going to achieve, what you're going to get. See what you can throw away. Mudi is called freedom. I've mentioned what freedom is in that earlier simile. Wherever you are in your meditation, please want to be here. Don't try and be somewhere else. If you've got sloth and torpor, please want to be in sloth and torpor. Be content to be here. If your mind is wandering all over the place, be content to have a wandering mind. Then you'll find freedom. That is the way you stop the mind wandering. Why does the mind wander anyway? Because discontent, you're not happy to be here. So the mind goes looking for something else. If you build up contentment, the mind becomes still. Contentment is the cause of peace, the stillness, the freedom. So whenever you're having a meditation, this is good enough for me. I'm being content. I'm not trying. A key story to this, a very embarrassing story, but I don't mind saying it. When I was in my 6th year as a monk in the north of Thailand, this was that what we call the Tudong year, where we can go out of the monastery, go wherever we want, and do whatever we want. So I found this perfect monastery. There was no one there. Actually, you know Ajahn Tiradhamma, he's from BC. Yep. He was in the next mountain. Just the next mountain, but it took a long time to get from one mountain to the next. So at that particular time, I had this monastery all to myself. And it was in a valley with a beautiful cave. I used to go there in the day and meditate for, you know, till the afternoon. And beautiful support. The village was just over the hill in another valley. So it's only about 20 minutes walk, and you go there, do your arms round, and the Northeasterners, they weren't interested in bothering you with questions. All they want to do is to feed you. So it's great, they just feed you, you give a blessing, and they leave you alone for the rest of the day. So you had the whole monastery to yourself, just to meditate, and no one to ask you any silly questions. Oh, it's bliss. The perfect place for solitude and for meditation. However, my mind started going crazy after a couple of weeks. These thoughts started to come into my mind, and it was very hard to stop them. And it got worse and worse, and many of the thoughts were very unmonkish thoughts, if you know what I mean. And I was trying my hardest. I'm a monk, you're not supposed to think of girls and romance and old girlfriends. But they kept on coming up in my mind, and I couldn't stop it. The worst thing was, I didn't have any other monk there to actually ask for some advice. I was stuck by myself, and I was still quite young as a monk, only 6 years. And it got so bad one day, that out of desperation, I went to the main sala, the main hall, in front of the Buddha statue, bowed and just asked for some inspiration, please. And the inspiration which came to me, maybe because I was a Westerner, was make a deal. So the deal was, I'd give my mind 1 hour every day from 3 p.m. to 4 p.m. in the afternoon where it could think about anything. Sex, girls, romance, the most deviant sexual fantasies were okay between 3 and 4, but the rest of the day you watch the breath, okay? That's what I did. Didn't work. Not the way I expected anyway, because my mind was still as wanton as ever. You try to stop it, it just wouldn't play. It just wouldn't agree. You'd go back to the breath, okay, watch the breath, and then just mind would be off with these fantasies, these memories, these ideas just breaking into your mind. And you stop it again, I'm a monk, I want to be a monk, this is not right. And you come in again, it's just so tiring. And frustrating too. When it got to 3 p.m. I had to keep the other side of the bargain. So I went up to my hut, leant against the wall, put my feet out because I'd been meditating all day, I felt so sore. I said, okay, whatever you want to think about now, anything goes. For the next hour my mind watched the breath, every breath without any problem. And that experience taught me how to let go. The difference between doing letting go and letting go. Before I've been trying to let go, I've been controlling my life. And that controlling, not making peace, but making war. The last time I was in Canada was 36 years ago, 1969, during the last part of the Vietnam War, when I was a hippie as well. I was going around, make peace, not war, make peace, not war. That's still my motto. In meditation, make peace, not war. Even if you have some terrible mind states, please make peace, not war. If you make war, you just have terrible collateral damage. If you make peace, your whole mind becomes peaceful. That's how I learned how to let go. one of the things. So now, can you notice why sometimes your meditation doesn't work? As Ajahn Chah used to say, where once there was a big party next to Watnana Chah in the early days, we complained to Ajahn Chah because the villagers would not listen to us. This music was going on to about 2 a.m. in the morning. About 2:15, they stopped the amplifiers and they went to sleep. But at 3 a.m. we had to get up. They wouldn't listen to us, so we thought, Ajahn Chah, you have got such a big reputation in this area. Can you tell these villagers, maybe go till midnight if you want to party, but please give us 2 or 3 hours of sleep. And Ajahn Chah came back and said this amazing saying, it is not the noise that disturbs you, it is you who disturb the noise. Brilliant insight. You disturb the noise. And I realized it wasn't the wandering mind disturbing me, I was disturbing my mind. I was making it wander. That's a problem. We don't know how to let things go, we make the problem. So if you just leave it alone, if you don't disturb the mind won't disturb you. May you be peaceful. Any questions about that one?
Shall we try that schedule here, the next 10-day retreat? Sound good? we're moving, we're evolving towards all these things. It is interesting as I listen how many parallels there are and discoveries. And if you just sit in an empty room long enough and have to figure this out, eventually you find the same kind of process.
In essence, very successful, I've been telling Ajahn Sona. People meditate much more when they're given freedom. Everyone is highly motivated. You don't go on a meditation retreat if you're lazy. You don't even sign up. So you've already got your motivation. You just want to have the gentleness, the compassion for yourself. And then you'll find that you'll sleep when you need to sleep. And when you wake up in the morning, because you're rested, you'll want to meditate. The mind will be inclined towards it, it will do it so easily. And in the meditation retreats, which I've been teaching with this method, there's always somebody in the hall meditating throughout the whole night. Because when it gets to 9 or 10 o'clock, in ordinary retreats, you may be very energetic, nice and peaceful, having a good time, but you won't meditate anymore because you have to get up at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. So you're throwing away your meditation success because of these schedules. So instead, if you're having a good time, you can carry on meditating. Who cares what time it is? You can catch up on your sleep another time. Which means that people feel free to meditate till 10, 11, 12, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning. They're not worried about having to get up in the morning. But if it's going well, you have to take that opportunity to allow it to get even deeper. And even there's always somebody, sometimes two people, every retreat, they miss their lunch. Because they're sitting in the morning and having such a good time, they just carry on. And they never regret it. They get out 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Did you miss your lunch? No. They say, that's a beautiful meditation. Naturally. Instead of forcing it. It's all part of letting go.
How did the... have you got any reflections on how the idea of the structured one hour this, 1 hour that type retreat developed? What was behind that? In a sense, when we read the suttas, we don't find even clocks. We do find much less formality and less structure, and the suggestion to go to quiet places and just meditate and sit and walk. When you need to walk, walk. When you're ready to sit, sit. So how this kind of very structured, temporal kind of...
All structure comes from fear. Fear of what will happen if I don't control life. So you put structure in your relationships. You put structure with your children. You're afraid, what would happen if I let them go and let them do whatever they want? You have structure for yourself because of fear. So just let go of the fear and trust in the Dhamma. You allow things just to flow and be. And things become nice and still. I read in the newspaper a long time ago that in Jerusalem, many years ago, the doctors went on strike for 2 weeks. During those 2 weeks, the death rate in all the hospitals went down. I don't know what that means, but we always think that, maybe when you leave things alone, things settle by themselves. So, I know that some people like structure because they're afraid. So, at least in Buddhist meditation we can have confidence that everyone is motivated enough. We trust. As a teacher, I trust my disciples. I have 21 monks in my monastery in Perth. I've been away for a long time. I haven't called them. They called me once when I was in Vancouver. I never had any intention of calling them to find out what's going on, because I trust them implicitly. I give them that trust, and they always live up to it. I let them go. Just the way I let my mind go. I'm not a control freak. Just sit down, put my butt on the cushion. Okay, mind, you take over now. If you do things like that, it's amazing how peaceful you can be, and how well a monastery can be run. And how easy it can be. So you don't get stressed out. You trust everybody to do their job. You're not always looking over their shoulder and seeing what the anagarika is doing. You don't have CCTV cameras in every room. What are you doing? Are you getting up? What time are you getting up, anagarika? You trust everybody. That's where you trust your mind. Your mind always does the right thing. Even there's another little strategy which you probably haven't heard yet, unless you've heard the most recent talks. Because I know that sometimes when people are meditating on retreat, they think they're going crazy. Sometimes they got an attack of all the 5 hindrances at once. That's what they say. So I use like one of the stories, a famous story from the time of the Buddha, which certainly all the Sri Lankans here would remember, because this is what you were taught in little Dharma school when you were young. Many others might remember the story of Nalagiri, the elephant. Because in the time of the Buddha, the last year or two of the Buddha's life, they wanted to assassinate him, and so somebody arranged to intoxicate this big bull elephant and to let him go along these narrow streets, charging and smashing everything in the path where the Buddha was coming on alms round. So this mad elephant was charging along. The Buddha was coming the opposite direction. People were running away, and they told the Buddha, just get out of the way, there's a mad elephant coming in this direction, quick! And all the monks ran away, except for Ananda, the Buddha's faithful attendant. Just like, you know, Venerable Paro would protect his teacher Ajahn Sona. He put himself in the front. He put himself in front of the Buddha. Ananda said, let the elephant take me, I'm protecting my master. And just probably what Ajahn Sona would do, this is what the Buddha did. Get out of the way, Ananda, I can look after this. And so he gently pushed Ananda aside, and he faced the raging elephant himself. And what did the Buddha do to this mad, intoxicating, raging elephant? The Buddha certainly did have psychic powers, immense powers. I have no doubt that the Buddha could have picked up that elephant by the trunk, mad as he was, heavy as he was, twirled him 3 times around his head and thrown him over the Ganges. But that's not the way of the Buddha. Instead, the Buddha gave him immense loving kindness. Nalagiri, the door of my heart is open to you. If you want to smash me up, that's fine. You want to trample all over me and kill me, smash every bone, I will never be angry and upset. I allow you to do whatever you want. It's loving kindness, opening the door of your heart, unconditionally. Whatever you do, whatever happens, the door of my heart will always be open to you, not again. With loving kindness like that, within a few seconds, that elephant was bending before the Buddha, allowing the Buddha to stroke the trunk. There, not again. There, not again. Good elephant. I call that the Nalagiri strategy. If your mind is like a mad raging elephant, charging through what to you, smashing everything up inside, don't use your willpower. Instead, use your loving kindness. Dear mind, you can do whatever you want to me. You can smash me up, stomp all over me, break every part of me. But mind, the door of my heart is always open to you, no matter what you ever do. Unconditional loving kindness, unconditional mindfulness to whatever's happening. Crazy mind, that's okay. And after a few seconds, you'll find your mind is kneeling to you. So peaceful, so calm, and you're just stroking it. There, mind, there, a nice mind, good mind. That's how you deal with the crazy mind. Because the reason it's crazy is you're feeding it with negativity. And I want to be like this. I want to be peaceful. I don't want to be wandering around thinking about this and struggling. So understand the causes, take away the causes, and then the effects will appear to you. And your mind will be just so docile. Just like that big raging elephant was carved by the Buddha. That's a simile of the Nalagiri strategy. In times of great madness in meditation, please try that.
One of the classic pieces of advice before meditating is to purify your virtue. Mm. So, can you speak to that a little bit?
Yes. If you want a good time in meditation, then you should be good. Makes a lot of sense to me. I know one of my classic stories, which always makes people have fun and enjoy it. How many of you heard that story about the man who got caught in a police road traffic block in Sydney? He'd been drinking? That is a classic story, a real story. It actually happened. Just like in Canada, the police will always try to catch drug drivers. People have been drinking too much and driving because that's really dangerous. So one day in Sydney, the police closed the road, had a police traffic block, testing every driver for their alcohol level. And this guy, he had been drinking. He was caught in the road traffic block. You can't do a U-turn because that's an admission of guilt. So he knew he was in big trouble. He just had to wait in line until it was his turn to get out of the car and blow into the tube, the breathalyzer tube. Is that what it's called in Canada, breathalyzer? Yes. So he waited, he realized he'd probably lose his license and a lot of money. So when it was his turn, he got out of the car. He was resigned to his fate. There was no other alternative. So the policeman gave him the tube. He was about to blow into it when there was a sound and a crash. Only a light crash. One of the cars approaching the railroad traffic block be going slightly too fast. It was a traffic hazard and it rear-ended the car in front. The policeman heard that crash and said to the man, "It's more important I attend to this crash than test your alcohol level. Get back in your car and go home." It was that close, within a couple of seconds of getting caught. And he thought he was so lucky. But the story did not end yet. The following morning, he was awoken by someone persistently ringing his doorbell. He had a hangover, but he quickly put some clothes on, went to the door, opened it, and there was two big policemen. Of course, he was scared at first, but then he came to his senses. He thought, "I'm not driving now, they can't do anything." And the policeman didn't want to check his alcohol level. All they wanted to do, they said, was to look inside his garage. He said, "Well, I'm not a burglar, I've got no stolen goods in there." "Sure you can." So he opened the door of his garage, and when he did, he almost had a heart attack. Because in his garage there was a police car. Right. got it. He got in the wrong car. But it said go home. He got the police car. They had they were missing a car at the roadblock. They had an extra car. They soon worked out what happened. I think he's still in jail. Which is a true story. And one thing which happens if you drink too much. So the point is that we keep our virtue good. The point of virtue is made very clear when you get to the stage of meditation of the nimittas. Because once you've settled the five senses down, remember there were six senses. From early Buddhism we always had six senses, not just the five senses of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting and physical touch, but also the mind as well. As an aside, those six senses, even like they were part of Greek philosophy as well, where the Western world was supposed to have it, the origin of its culture and its philosophy. If ever you read Aristotle, you find he said there was a sixth sense called the mind, and he actually called it the common sense, because the mind could actually hear what the ear hears, to see what the eye sees. It was common to all the other senses. And so very often I joke the problem with the Western world is somewhere in the last 2,000 years we lost our mind and we lost our common sense. But it did have a mind. And what happens in meditation is through this path of watching the breath you are literally suppressing the five senses. So you're not seeing anything, you're turning off sight. You're turning off smell, taste. The way you turn off touch is by watching one physical touch object, the breath, until that fades away, and then you can't feel anything of your body at all. Physical touch has disappeared. And you may have noticed the last thing which disappears is the sense of sound. That's one of the hardest to shut down. But you shut them down one after the other. When they're all shut down, the only thing left is the mind, the six senses. So when the breath disappears in this breath meditation, that is a sign that the five external senses have been suppressed enough for the mind to become dominant. So the sense of mind is now the major sense at play in your experience. And that always manifests as a beautiful light in the mind. It was a great insight for me to understand that what you were seeing at that stage of nimitta was a reflection of your mind. The clues were there in the suttas, but I never saw them. But once you have those experiences again and again, what is this nimitta, this beautiful light? I realized it was a reflection of your mind, literally looking at your mind in a mirror. However, sometimes when you get to that stage, the nimitta, this light, is not beautiful, but is stained, or even dirty and grubby. The next insight which came after several months was realizing that staying is dirty because of your precepts, or not precepts, but even like saying wrong things to somebody else. Literally, you understand why virtue is important at that stage of meditation. That gives you the brightness, the purity of the mind. It's been so clear to me over the last 10 or 15 years I've been teaching like this, that on a retreat, because my disciples I've known for many years come on these retreats, it's very easy for me to predict which ones will have wonderful meditation experiences. Because it's those with a pure mind. The pure-hearted people. The ones who come looking after the monastery, helping others, never say a bad word to anybody. Who keep virtue just easily, they're not just playing, they just are virtuous. What in normal parlance, normal speech we call the pure-hearted people. You know people like that, they're always so kind, they're so good. They're asking, can you help me? I say, yeah, sure. I always want to give you things. They never say a bad word about anybody. They're just really kind, good people. Those are the ones who have this beautiful mind. So when the five senses fade away, the mind is beautiful, radiant, wonderful. And so they have an easy time making the next stage into the jhanas. is at that stage in particular, when the nirvana comes up, you realize why you need a good, virtuous, compassionate, kind, generous, pure-hearted lifestyle to take you into the jhanas. However, there is a trick, if you're not so good. To take that mind into the jhanas, because it's always a part of a nimitta, even a dull and dirty one. It's never all stain, it's always a part of it which is beautiful. Because it's always a part of your day which is very wonderful. You're not all bad, basically. You have a part of you which is very pure and nice, but sometimes you forget. So when you see that nimitta, I've taught my disciples, just look at the beautiful part of it. Don't look at the dull and the great part. And if you just, a person can always look at the good side of life, the good part of a person, the good part of yourself. You're not a fault finder. But you forget the faults and look at the beauty in other people, the beauty in life, the beauty in yourself. Then you can see the beauty in the nimitta. Just literally turn away from the dirty part and you just see the nice spot part. You just focus in on that. You focus in on that, and just that beautiful part expands. You focus into the centre of that. There's always a beautiful part in the centre of everything. You always go to the most beautiful part. You focus in, you zero in on that. Then the nimitta just shines up and becomes so beautiful and so radiant. And that's actually a way of bypassing sort of the faults in your virtue. You can do that. This is just practical. I'm not sure if you should do it, but you can. You do do it. And you can get into these beautiful nimittas. Perhaps it's just another way of saying forgiveness. Letting go of the faults and just focusing on the beautiful part of you. Focusing on the beautiful part of the nimitta. And then just go to the jhanas. So that's the way around the lack of virtue. It works, so why not teach it? But of course it's easier. The more pure you are, the easier it is. I don't think you can be really, really, really heedless and find some part of a nimitta which is beautiful enough to take you into jhana. So you're really asking for trouble. Is there any questions from the floor as well? Yes, sir.
You're speaking in very visual terms about the nimitta. Are there other ways that people who don't have a good visual sense experience it?
Are there other ways of experiencing nimitta than through the visual sense? I was never a visual person. But this is the way nimittas come to me, the best way. It is true, I've got to admit this, you can get nimittas which are feeling nimittas. However, they are not as easy to work with as the visual ones. And because of those experiences, they're not visual, they're not feeling, they're mind objects, this is the way we interpret it. So I always encourage people to please interpret it in a visual sense. It's not that hard to do. If you interpret it in a visual sense, if you look at it in a visual way, you encourage the visual nimitta, it's much easier to work with and take it into jhanas. You've got more stuff there to play around with, to be able to take it into a jhana. If it's just a feeling, it's not enough handles on it for actually to take it further. You can though, it does happen, you can get a nimitta which is equivalent to like a physical sensation, or is it perceived as a physical sensation, it's not a physical sensation at all, which can, yeah, take you into a jhana, but it's more difficult to do it that way. And for most people it's a visual thing anyway. And if you encourage it even more, yeah, it becomes a visual thing. And it's not that just monks do these things. Lay people can do these things. Have some great experiences of people doing these things. And they get wonderful sense of an understanding of the depth of the Buddha's teachings. They did these things in the time of the Buddha. And it's getting one of my missions in life is to keep teaching not just second-rate Buddhism to the lay community. Not just sort of, you know, to talk down to you guys, but to teach as much as I possibly can. This is possible. You never think, you're just a lay person, you can never do these things. Of course you can. I've tried it, it works, you can do it. Obviously, if you're a monk or a nun, there's more commitment there, there's more time, there's a greater purity because of the greater precepts. So there's more likelihood that monks and nuns can get these states, but it's not closed to any layperson. Especially these days, we have retreats. You do 1 month retreats, 3 month retreats, or whatever, so you've got a great chance of doing this, and people do it. And sometimes they get these beautiful nimittas, and the teacher doesn't tell them what's happening, and so they miss the chance, or they get incredible bliss, and they think, ah, something is wrong, I'll get attached to it. You don't get attached to the bliss. Actually, you do get attached to the bliss, but the Buddha said in the Pasadika Sutta, anyone who gets attached to the bliss of meditation can expect only one of four consequences. This is what the result of being attached to the bliss of meditation. The four consequences are stream winning, once returning, non-returning, or full enlightenment. That's the only possibilities if you're attached to the bliss of meditation. I don't think that's all that bad. That's Pasadika Sutta. He also said in particular so many times in the Latuki Kokama Sutta, what else would be, Mahamalunkyaputta Sutta, Ranavibhanda Sutta, even the Mahasajika Sutta, that the bliss of meditation you should not be afraid of, not by Yitabhang, that you should develop, make much of, and follow. So the bliss is of meditation, the pleasure of meditation. Never throw that away. Never think that's a danger. Don't be afraid of it. Go for it full time. Enjoy your meditation. Bliss out to the max. And then you get all these happy meditators. And they enjoy it. That's why we don't have any structure, to make it more pleasant, more enjoyable, to make the meditation fun. And if you get bored with the breath meditation, I should say this because this is another thing I've been teaching in North America. It's the first time in North America that we've taught backwards breath meditation. Have you heard that before? Of course not. This is the first time this special secret teaching has been revealed to the world here in North America. Backwards breath. Have you heard that? Yeah, backwards breath meditation from Power. Really? I've been teaching this for a while now. When you do breath meditation, what do? You watch your breath go in, watch the breath go out. In, out, in, out, in, out. Backwards breath meditation means when you start watching the breath, you watch the out breath first, and then the in breath. Out, breathing in. Out, in. You try it. You'll find it's completely different. It's called backwards breath meditation. What it does, it makes people more mindful because they're watching in a different perspective. More interesting, they don't get so bored. They're just playing around. And playing around is an important part of meditation. It makes it playful, joyful. Next time you do meditation, you try it, backwards breath meditation. Don't try it now. When you're meditating on the breath, try backwards breath meditation. You watch the out breath first, then the in breath. You think it's the same, but it ain't. Try and see. That's the first time in North America for 2,000 years a backwards breath meditation was taught. Yeah, go.
You mentioned letting go, and you also indicated that point. There is a point where you let discipline.
Yes.
And letting go of all, even that mindset.
Yeah.
Is that where
yeah. This is.
It's a level, and I don't need that. Just as a discriminatory description, when you do let go of that, and just let be.
Yeah. Trust is a good word. the sugar which I've used in states of meditation, you get so far. And it's like you're driving a car, and you hand the keys over to somebody else to drive. You trust them. So you can just relax and do no more driving. In your meditation, as soon as you give the keys up and let the mind, let nature drive the process of meditation, the better. If you can't let go, you can just make that visualization. That you've been driving your body and mind. You've got the keys to the car. And you give it to somebody else. You let go of control. And that trust, the full trust. For those of you who know Pali, know the description of the jhanas, the second jhana, the most important word in that is the Jatang Sampasadama. Sometimes it's called internal confidence. Because some of the times the people who translate those words, they have no experience of the jhanas. So they've got the words there, and it could mean many things, they don't really get to the point there. In the second jhana, the mind is so trusted in the object. That's where the full letting go happens, in the second jhana. The Ajahn Sampasadana means full trust. Sampasadana means faith. It also means joy, that joyful faith in what you're doing. You completely let go. And that's the time when the mind is absolutely still for the first time. That's the full time, first time when you understand what samadhi truly is. Absolute stillness of mind, there's no movement possible. The rock, the diamond samadhi, absolutely still, nothing moving. No possibility for a thought or an intention to arise at all. You can't do anything there. Will is frozen. And that trust, that's the first time that will disappears completely, or rather the potential to do this kind. And that's immovable, like a mountain. So those are descriptions which people have of that second jhana state. It always becomes because the trust has come to its maximum potential. Because you're fully letting go, there's no more movement possible. What you really let go of is the doer, the will, choice. That which moves the world is now stopped. You. Does that make sense? So trust is an important thing. All people are control freaks. It's called craving. I just use the word control freak because that's a buzzword. So instead of saying that craving is the cause of suffering, being a control freak is a cause of suffering. So when you stop controlling things and controlling our mind, when we let go, then we're at peace. And the Buddha said so clearly in the second teaching, the Anathalakana Sutta, the second teaching where he got the first arahats in the world, other than the Buddha. He said, look, this body isn't yours, it doesn't belong to you. If it did belong to you, you could say, may my body be like this, may it not be like that. But you can't do that because the body is not yours, it's not your business. It's like your waiver, your pleasure and pain. If that was belonged to you, you can say, may I always feel pleasure, never pain. You should be experienced enough now to know that you're not in control of your pleasure and pain. Because it doesn't belong to you. It's not me, not mine, yourself. It's none of your business. Leave it alone. Stop trying to get rid of pain, trying to get pleasure. Waste of time. Perceptions, will, consciousness, all these things don't belong to you. If they did belong to you, you can say, oh, may my consciousness be like this, may it not be like that. But you can't do that because it doesn't belong to you. It's not your business. So don't get involved in what's not your business. Let it go instead. When I leave here tomorrow morning, I'm not going to worry about any of you at all. You're not my business. So you're free, finally, carrying nothing. I'm completely responsible. Yeah, what?
Are there any, as a single objective measurement, people often ask me, am I succeeding in meditation, specifically concentration meditation, samatha meditation? Is there, aside from descriptions like joy or ease, or etc. Are there any other objective type of measurements that the person might use to see if they're in the same ballpark?
Okay, I'm going to go off on a tangent here, because when you mention the word measurement, red lights come up. Simply because that some years ago someone mentioned to me a scientist, philosopher called Lord Kelvin. If any engineers or anyone who remembers of physics, they will know that he gave his name to the absolute scale of temperature, which starts at minus 273. Does it get that cold here, Birkin? But in particular, this guy, Lord Kelvin, he was a philosopher, he was one of the originators of what we now call technology. He said the only way we can control nature is to learn how to measure her first. Measure her accurately first. He made a connection between measurement and control. Governments will measure you to try and control you. That's why they have censuses. That's why they have all these surveys. Once it's measurement, control becomes possible. The opposite is also true. When there's no measurement, control becomes impossible. An understanding that controlling is the obstacle to depth in meditation. I really encourage people not to measure their meditation at all. When you don't measure, letting go happens as a natural course. You're unable to control anymore. So when you're meditating, another way to let go is not to measure. When you don't measure time in minutes, the only time you have is now. You just go into the present moment so easily when you're not measuring. Sometimes you measure your meditation. How long have you meditated for? Half an hour, hour? Did you beat your record next time? Ajahn Brahm said you can meditate for 4 or 5 hours. Yeah, I'm going to do that. Stop that measuring. Just be in the moment. It doesn't matter how many hours or minutes or whatever. When you don't measure, how can you think? All thinking comes is a measurement. So when you stop measuring, thought stops. You stop measuring the breath disappears. You stop measuring the world disappears. It's a great way of letting go, because when you don't measure, you just can't do anything. You stop measuring your meditation into being good or bad. There's no good or bad meditation. If once you think of bad meditation, then you get frustrated, you have to make it better. Even if it's a good meditation, once you get the word good, it's never good enough. It can always be gooder. Or better, rather. This is one of the problems with measuring. Measuring is the beginning of controlling. So once you stop measuring your meditation, you're free. And you get to the immeasurable state. Apamana. And those are great ways of letting go in meditation. So you're sitting there. Don't think this is a good or bad meditation. Don't measure it at all. And then contentment, peace, letting go just happens. And it's just so easy. There's another way of letting go. However, if you really want to measure your meditation, what Ajahn Sona really meant is, how do you know if you're really getting anywhere in the meditation? It's just by the peace, the happiness, the joy, and the level of bliss. So meditation is supposed to make you happier and happier and happier, more ecstatic. So when those things are happening, great. Ecstasy is a sign of freedom. You've got no burdens anymore. Suffering is ending. When suffering finishes, what do you expect? But the opposite of suffering, which is bliss. That's why that next book called The Beautiful Breath, I think the subtitle is The Meditative Way of Bliss or something. Put your bliss in the title, because that's important to understand that meditation is a way of great happiness, enormous joy. The joy is mental energy. So the more mental energy you have, the more joy you have, the deeper your meditation. So as a teacher, people come into the interviews and they say this, they say that. I get more information about where they're at their meditation from their smile the sparkle in their eyes, the joy which they're experiencing. They can't fake that. They can fake all these words they say, my experience is, I saw a light, blah blah blah. If they say, yeah, I saw a light, it was a very much beautiful light, then I went into the jhanas and never did that, I'll shut up. Usually, at the end, I'll go, I got the most wonderful state of. That's usually what happens, they're just so excited and bubbling and full of energy, they're crazy. They're beautifully crazy, though. It's so sweet when they get to jhanas for the first time. It's one of the great joys of being a teacher to see that, witness it. It's just like they've fallen in love, only more so. And it's just, oh, that is so nice. Come on, any other questions anyone's got? I know that Sajjan Sona said this morning about the importance of questions and that's important for intelligence, but I really thought you were going to quote the Mahakavabhanga Sutta.
And?
That said, that's a sutta where the Buddha described the karmic causes for your future lives. What you have to do in this life to be reborn in a wealthy family and get wealth in your next life. while other things you do may cause poverty for yourself in your future life. The Buddha also said the karmic cause why some people will be reborn ugly in their future life. And I never look at anybody now when I say ugly because I made a big mistake. I got a problem. I said, why are you looking at me, Ajahn Brahma? Why other people will be reborn beautiful in the next life? What's the karmic cause for these things? But in particular, the Buddha said the karmic cause, what you have to do in this life, to be reborn intelligent in your next life, while other people will be reborn stupid in their next life. The reason why people will be reborn dumb in the future lives is because they do not ask questions in this one. So now, does anyone want to ask a question?
I mean, I'm making merit and more merit all the time. I just want to let everybody else do a little opportunity for that.
Yeah.
I've been doing your loving kindness instructions on the CD where you visualize a little kitten out in the wilderness, it's cold. And that's a really good kind of kick starting technique. Just want to give them more loving kindness instructions.
Yeah, one of the, again, as a Buddhist, not just as a monk or as a teacher, be innovative. So, you know, find your own little ways of doing these meditations. You know, I learnt a lot from the other people which I listened to. I expanded them and took them in different directions, which is great when we innovate in our path. So I found it difficult to start loving kindness on myself or on other beings when I was very young. You just couldn't put loving kindness on yourself or all other beings. In Thailand, we had in this chant, may all beings be happy and well. I just couldn't do that. I found myself saying, may all beings except mosquitoes be happy and well. They didn't deserve any happiness. What it did to me was disgusting. But of course that never worked and it just became superficial and very hard. I was meant to do loving kindness meditation, but I couldn't do it. It made it frustrating. I couldn't do it honestly because I never had loving kindness to all beings, only the ones which I liked. I mean, I think later on that I think one of the breakthroughs was understanding or getting a metaphor that loving kindness is like lighting a fire. If you light a fire, you can't start with a big log when you light a fire, like a campfire. You have to start with paper, which easily takes the flame. And then you put on kindling, small pieces of wood, then you put on bigger twigs, and then bigger pieces of logs, and only when you've got enough heat can you put on the big logs. And once you've got the big logs on and it's really roaring, then you can put on the wet logs. You put anything on a big fire and anything burns. And in that simile, to start loving kindness meditation, you try and find something which is so easy to have loving kindness towards, just to get the fire lit. And then you put on other objects, and other objects. And once you've got big logs on, then you can put the hardest logs on, the sappy logs, your enemies like yourself. To be honest about it. And that will take a flame. That's great when you get loving kindness, really strong, a big flame, big fire going. Whatever enemy you have, maybe your ex-partner in your last marriage or whatever, whoever it was who really hurt and harmed you, when you have huge amounts of loving kindness, just think about them, it's just so easy to love them. You find it surprising. Actually, I can, this guy or this girl who really, really cheated me, took all my money, took my house, my clothes, my kids, everything, and they didn't deserve it at all, the one you really hate in life, you can love them. Because your fire is so strong, it can evaporate all the sap and the wetness from any log, and it takes the flame. But the point is, you have to start with things which are easy. Which is why, because I like cats, and especially little kittens, I like a little kitten, they're so lovable. So I imagine a little kitten, and I make it just the most lovable kitten, but I imagine it's just destitute, just abandoned. Just really dirty, hungry, and just terribly afraid. And I build up a commentary. I just make it up as I go along. And I close my eyes and imagine this poor little being who's never had a moment of happiness in its little life. It's so hungry and afraid. And I just look at it. And it's so frightened of me. I just warm it with my kindness and just gently reach out to it. Stroke it so gently. It's so terrified of touch. But she's got a little bit of hope, trust. It may have found someone who can care for it and protect it. And just gently I build up that hope in that little kitten. Just with my eyes I just give it heaps and heaps of loving kindness. And when I find it trusting me, I bring it gently to my chest and warm it. Little kitten. You've got a friend. Someone who will always protect you and care for you. Will always love you. Play with you. Feed you. For the rest of my life. And straight away I get these beautiful feelings of compassion coming up. And warmth. And then I go to other people. I have my imaginary piece of paper which I like loving kindness on. And the other ones, it's so easy afterwards. I think of maybe a best friend, a fellow monk or something, or my mother. I put the twigs on. And I really get into it. I really make it feel good and I'm not afraid of crying. I really get these emotions coming up strong and then they say, may all beings are no different from a little kid who's abandoned and lonely and hungry. And I just give this beautiful loving kindness to the whole world. And I remember my enemies. Ah, they're not that bad. They're just silly little children, that's all, doing silly things as I've been learned. Just a big souk inside, a big softy, and a hard exterior. Mr. Bush. He's doing his best. He's a bit stupid, that's all. he's not such a bad guy. He gives us loving. You can do anybody loving kindness, and you've really got to get into it. And then you do yourself as well. Silly Edgar Brown, you're just totally terrible jokes. And so you give yourself this beautiful loving kindness. And the whole world is affected. And you're blissing out. Because that emotion of loving kindness is another way of calling letting go. You're letting go of criticism, fully accepting yourself and all other beings. As they are. Not fault finding at all. Putting aside the faults, seeing the beautiful part in every living being. And you get this beautiful energy. Which, you know, just then, very often you can imagine it as being this beautiful golden ball of light. That's a useful way of imagining loving kindness coming from your heart, spreading over the whole world. Right? You can imagine these rays just radiating out, spreading over everybody. And you just imagine that golden ball is the source of this amazing loving kindness. And there's your limiter, the metta limiter. It's this beautiful, incredibly incandescent light in your heart. It's so beautiful and so delicious. You just focus on that. Forget what it's called. And that becomes an limiter which takes you into jhana very, very easily. because metta is full of power and joy and happiness. So that's how you do loving kindness, not to the metta chants. One of the things which I've been teaching in the retreats when you do metta, it's great fun. Usually I finish off the retreats with a metta meditation, and then I get into this, and then towards the end I tell people, right now, imagine one person who you're very close to in this life. Imagine them, and just with this incredible power, zap them with loving kindness, with metta. Just really wham! For about a minute or two. And then I open my eyes while I'm doing this, and everyone else keeps their eyes closed, and I note down the time. And then I tell people at the end of the retreat, this was the time you zap that person with loving kindness. When you go home after the retreat, if you live with them, or if you don't live with them, give them a call, SMS them or something, and ask them, at that time, if you don't mind me asking, what were you doing? See if they felt it. You wouldn't believe, just, I expect this now, when I get back to my monastery, ding, 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 telephone rings, it worked, Ajahn Bob, it worked. They can't help, they get so excited, telling me it worked. They ask their partner or something, what their time said. Amazing you thought you asked that question, because I was thinking of that time. Well, I was being sad, I thought of you, I felt so happy. Just to show you it does work. So you have to do that experiment yourself. Get really strong loving kindness. And you may be here at this Birken Monastery, you may think of someone even back in Vancouver. You zap them. Notice the time. And don't ask them a leading question. Just ask them a question that can be answered any which way. And you'll find out that, yeah, they felt it. So it's amazing just to do. It's not a psychic power, a miracle, it's just nature. But to actually just show you the power of loving kindness. It does actually work, and people feel it. That's why I note down the time, because at that time, yeah, they were thinking of you. It's a little miracle, which you can do for yourself. A question, or just scratching your nose?
Okay. Is that maybe more beautiful or maybe more intelligent? it's coming back to this issue of trust. So yes. Sometimes you can get pretty quiet in meditation and things are starting to still. And you can see that you're hanging on to something pretty big. And you start to see that it's really uncomfortable too, like that it'd probably be better if you let this go. Mm. But you also don't really know what you're surrendering to, and it's kind of the only thing you have, right? So how do you deal with the fear that comes up and easily let this stuff go?
How do you overcome the fear in this particular stage? It's actually through the power of bliss. Especially in the deeper parts of meditation, yeah, you have to let go of something. It is the only thing you have, your last possession. But it's just so much fun. You can see over there, if I let this go, I'm so much fun, I don't want to let this go, but it's so much fun, I don't want to let it go, what the hell are you going for? That's usually what happens. Just a bliss pulls you in. Mm. You can't resist it. What the hell? I'm going for it. It also helps when people like me teach like this, because I'm encouraging you to go for it, not to be afraid. It also helps for you to read what the Buddha said, and to realize you're in good company. Because if you read the Mahasatika Sutra, which is part of the story of the Buddha's own enlightenment, for years he never did jhanas, because he was afraid of the bliss. And it says I can almost quote it word for word, the Buddha, when he remembered doing jhanas under the rose apple tree as a boy, he said, "Why have I been afraid of that bliss which has nothing to do with unwholesome things? I will not be afraid of that bliss." He went for it and gained enlightenment. But even the Bodhisattva was afraid of the bliss. You're in excellent company. Also, it helps to understand that this is why, when you meditate in this way, you do come across your core attachments. These are what attachments mean. What you're unwilling to let go of to go deeper. So the path of jhanas gets to the core attachments, the underlying ones, not the superficial ones, but the deep ones which stand between you and full enlightenment. So now you understand why it's hard to become enlightened. You want to let go, but you can't. You want to let go, but you can't. But there's bliss, a bit of confidence, because you understand some of the Buddhist teachings. Like monks who give talks like this, encouraging you, yeah, go for it, it's great, it's wonderful, go for it, do it. Little by little, that will encourage you, like the coach standing by the touchline, shouting at you, go on, go for it, you can do it. And the joy, which you can see in the future, just one step ahead if you cross over. Those are the things which will push you over. And once you've gone over, you understand that there's so much peace and bliss, and you see what you're attached to. And then you understand what these attachments are, and why they are the cause of suffering. Why they stop you being free and blissful. In particular, the attachment to the self and things which you think you own, such as your body. So the great question, you've seen it accurately, hopefully you can see the next step and go further, just bliss out and be free. Is that all what you're asking?
Mm-hmm, that's great.
So we have a
question over there.
Another question. When I meditate, I see things in blue, I see things in purple. It's just like it's exploding inside of me. It's like the whole universe itself. But I've read where,
the blue light and purple light is very common. It's a very beautiful limiter. It's a great one. So that's marvelous. The colour is what we add on. It's these are mental images which we perceive at the limiter stage. Whether it's white or purple or blue or red. We even had one guy who had a black limiter. He said it's the most deep and beautiful and satiny, rich black he'd ever seen in his life. He said it's incredibly powerful and deep. So yeah, that's a limiter. Blues and purples are very, very common. It's like a cosmic colour. But it's the colour of the sky at night time. And if I remember going to Guatemala, the Mayans, that was always the amazing colour from their paintings. An incredibly deep and brilliant blue. So that's a great colour. I think